national LPA events. Dan and Ruth developed the LPA website in the early days of the internet, and Dan continued to manage and edit it for many years. Becky has had some learning issues, which Dan attributes to hearing loss, a not uncommon complication among people with achondroplasia. When I interviewed Dan, Becky was 10 and a half, and her father was anticipating the difficult waters of adolescence. Becky looks in the mirror, and she likes what she sees, Dan said. But I don't kid myself. I assume that her most bitter critique of dwarfism is yet to come. Every adult dwarf I've ever talked to, almost without exception, says by the time they hit their 20s, they're proud of who they are and wouldn't change anything. But their teen years were hell. She doesn't have many friends now, and it's only going to become more difficult. Dan began writing Little People, Learning to See the World Through My Daughter's Eyes. I look at dwarfism as a metaphor for difference, he said. Whether we value it, whether we fear it, whether we would stamp it out if given the opportunity. The research he did gave Dan insights that have helped Becky. He got a handicap placard for his car because he realized that walking long distances was bad for anyone with a compressed spine. Lee Kitchens, former president of LPA, said to me, "Better a handicap placard now than a scooter when she's 30," Dan said. In his book, Dan complains that the freedom people felt in approaching him with questions about his daughter communicated the unspoken message that Becky is public property and that her parents are obliged to explain her to the world. Whether they like it or not, parents of dwarf children often feel they must display their families as emblems of diversity. I'd like to think grappling with this has made me a better person, Dan said, but I still don't think I'm very patient. Frankly, your life is in the hands of outside forces, and you just have to go with it. This definitely made me better at that. More than 200 genetic conditions lead to exceptionally short stature. Approximately 70% of dwarfs have achondroplasia. Other dwarfing conditions include pseudoachondroplasia, spondyloepiphyseal dysplasia congenita, or SED, and diastrophic dysplasia. Little People of America designates as a dwarf anyone who is 4'10" or under as the result of a medical condition. This description does not officially include people with dwarfing conditions who grow taller than 4'10", nor would it apply to children with no genetic anomalies whose dwarfism results from malnutrition or parental abuse and neglect. Nonetheless, such people are in general welcomed at LPA. The average height of a female achondroplastic dwarf is 4 feet, and of a male, 4'3". There are more than 200,000 people of short stature in the United States, and Victor McCusick, a geneticist specializing in diseases of connective tissue, has estimated that there are several million worldwide. The distance such people must travel to find expert help can be considerable. Medical costs can be staggering. Insurance often covers only a fraction of the liability a family faces. More than 24 physicians serve on LPA's medical advisory board, and conferences allow dwarfs to avail themselves of expert advice. The mechanism of achondroplasia is an overactive gene, the same one that causes the bones of average people to stop growing at the end of adolescence. This process is kicked into gear prematurely by a variation of a single nucleotide. Achons, slang for people with achondroplasia, have short limbs in proportion to a fairly average trunk and a large head with a protuberant forehead. People with SED, a more disabling condition, tend to be shorter than those with achondroplasia. They often have club feet, cleft palate, wide-set eyes, a small mouth, and a barrel chest that develops when their ribs grow faster than their spine. Diastrophic dysplasia is distinguished by club feet and cleft palate, hitchhiker's thumb, which is low on the hand and has little flexibility, and a cauliflower ear, similar to the calcified ear deformities that many professional boxers develop. Diastrophic dwarfs often become so bent that they are unable to walk. The condition results from a recessive gene, so both parents must be carriers and are usually unaware of it. Though the numbers vary, it would appear that achondroplasia occurs in about 1 in 20,000 births, while 1 in 10,000 has a dwarfing condition, some of them fatal. Since newborns always have short limbs in relation to their heads and torsos, the revelation, as with deafness, may come immediately or may be gradual. Most dwarfs are diagnosed by the age of 2. Because their chests are small, their airways may be dangerously narrow, leading to rapid breathing, obstructions, and sleep disturbances. Infants with achondroplasia are also at increased risk for life-threatening brainstem compression, in which pressure on the lower brain impedes its function. A study of mortality in achondroplasia determined that the risk of dying within the first 4 years of life was more than 1 in 50. The chance of dying in childhood, adolescence, or young adulthood is also vastly increased. The body temperature of newborn dwarfs is somewhat higher than that of average infants, and carbon dioxide retention causes them to sweat more. Hydrocephalus and recurrent, damaging ear infections caused by variations in craniofacial shape may also complicate matters. Several other low-incidence conditions are associated with mental retardation, including dwarfism caused by inadequate iodine, intrauterine growth restriction, or psychosocial deprivation. Although cognitive and intellectual development generally proceeds apace, little people may still be challenged at school because of early oxygen deprivation resulting from an underdeveloped pulmonary system, because of damage to their hearing from the repeated ear infections to which they are prone, or because of the need to focus energy on compensating for social stigma. Early diagnosis is critical. Many serious complications can be avoided through appropriate prophylactic treatment. Children with achondroplasia should have X-rays and scans to monitor their neurological and skeletal development. They may need complex dental work if their jaw is too small for their teeth. Some children have spinal columns too thin for their nerves to fit in without being pinched. This can lead to weakness, numbness, and pain. Small airways make the risk of anesthesia higher for dwarfs. If a curvature of the spine is not corrected early on, a dwarf child may develop a hunchback. An infant with a skeletal dysplasia should not be left sitting up, as his head is too heavy for his spine to support. Additionally, he should not be placed in any seat that curves the back. Car seats should be padded to prevent him from resting his chin on his chest. Because their heads are too heavy for their necks, many young children with achondroplasia cannot hold them up when they are crouching. Only a fifth of them learn to crawl. Snow plowing and reverse snow plowing entail resting the head on the floor as a balancing point while using the legs for propulsion. Spider crawling, log rolling, army crawling, and seat scooting involve exactly the sorts of motion that their vivid names imply. When children with achondroplasia are ready to walk, they often stand by jackknifing, keeping their head on the floor while straightening their legs, then lifting the upper body to achieve a full upright posture. Muscle tone may be low, and joints may be unusually stiff or loose. Short-statured children perform these and many other acts in a unique way, or at a later developmental stage, and LPs are supposed to avoid gymnastics, high diving, acrobatics, and collision sports because of possible joint and skeletal issues. They are encouraged to do swimming, golf, and other low-impact sports. Because LP children should properly eat only about half as much as their average counterparts, many struggle with weight, a problem that LPA attempts to address in educational materials and panel discussions. In adulthood, LPs may suffer chronic back problems, allergies, sinus problems, arthritis, rheumatism, hearing impairments, spine deformities, sleeping difficulties, chronic neck pain, or paralysis or weakness of the upper or lower limbs. They are far more likely than their average counterparts to undergo surgeries throughout life. The defining issues for most adult dwarfs are skeletal. The dysplasias are often associated with spinal stenosis, joint deformity and degeneration, and disc problems. In adults with achondroplasia, the narrowed spine often needs to be decompressed surgically to alleviate symptoms such as shooting pains down the legs, weakness, numbness, tingling, and pins and needles. Curvature of the spine may result in mechanical and neurological complications that affect the heart and the lungs, as well as mobility. Surgeries often performed on dwarfs include lumbar surgery for spinal stenosis to prevent paralysis and pain, cervical spine surgery that ameliorates limb weakness, surgical division or sectioning of bone for bow-leggedness, the insertion of shunts for hydrocephalus, and interventions to resolve obstructive apnea. Leslie Parks's parents were not pleased when she began hanging out with Chris Kelly during her senior year in high school in Huntsville, Alabama. The future they had imagined for their daughter had not included a romantic entanglement with a dwarf, even one who was a local celebrity, a DJ with his own radio show. "I was your typical middle kid. Nothing special about me," Leslie said. "So I sort of fell into it with him. I was in student government, and he would DJ parties. From the beginning, my parents were like, 'Nip it in the bud. He's divorced, he's got kids, he's a dwarf, he's a DJ, and he's no good.'" Leslie felt she was dating a star. But her parents didn't see it that way, and they threw her out of the house her senior year. Within a few months, Leslie and Chris were married. When Chris was young, his parents had tried every new treatment on the market, including injections of growth hormone made from the pituitary glands of monkeys. Because of or in spite of the shots, Chris had made it to 4'10", which is tall for a person with achondroplasia, and firmly refused to regard his dwarfism as a medical condition to be cured. He got into being a DJ and a stand-up comic because he needed the approval of the masses to feel good about himself, Leslie said. What he didn't particularly need was a one-on-one relationship. Chris's two children from his previous relationship were both of average height. When Leslie became pregnant a few months after marrying Chris, she had no thought that she might be carrying a dwarf. At 7 months, she went for an ultrasound. They said, "His head is too big for 7 months, but his femur is much too short for 7 months. What's going on here?" Leslie knew exactly what was going on. "I was devastated. I'm glad I found out ahead of time, because I had time to get the morning over with by the time he was born." Leslie could not talk to her husband about her despair at the prospect of a child who resembled him. A tomboy who went through precocious puberty, Leslie had always had a skewed self-image. "In third grade, I was developing already, and people made fun of me. I was always ashamed that my body wasn't right." She was overweight when she met Chris, became bigger after they married, and grew enormous and somewhat depressed when she had Jake. "I remember bringing him home from the hospital thinking, 'This is the worst babysitting job I've ever had. When is his mother coming for him?'" Leslie's parents were horrified to have a dwarf grandson, but over time, their attitude softened. Leslie's mother was a pediatric nurse, and she sent Leslie to a neurologist at Birmingham Children's Hospital who had experience with LPs. Leslie's pediatrician had told her that Jake's frequent vomiting was normal and that she could straighten him out when he arched his back in his sleep. Then the specialist said, "Does he sleep with his head back and his neck arched? That's how they achieve the most free, unobstructed breathing. Don't move his head." "I didn't know." Chris, like the local doctors, tended to minimize his son's condition, while Leslie's parents clearly regarded her life as a calamity. Leslie and Chris became increasingly alienated as they navigated these issues, eventually divorcing when Jake was 2. As a child, Jake would sometimes weep, saying, "I don't want to be little." Leslie wanted to cry, too. "What would be wrong about letting him know that you hurt for him, too?" she said. "You don't want your child to perceive that you think his situation is hopeless. But also, you don't want to deny his experience." A few times I've said, "Have you talked to your daddy about this?" "No, I'm crying because I don't want to be like me, which means I don't want to be like him. That would hurt his feelings." Jake had some learning delays. His focus has been social rather than academic. By the time he finished 3rd grade, Leslie was worried he was falling behind. Private testing revealed that he had a learning disability, so she transferred him to a magnet school for special education. He hated it. "Jake can act," Leslie said. "He's done stuff on TV. He's very outgoing. He can think it, he can speak it, but as far as putting it down on paper, he can't do that for shit." "You are entitled to free occupational therapy for fine motor skills for young dwarfs, but your pediatrician has to refer you." "I didn't know to ask." When Jake was a few years old, Chris remarried. Soon his new wife, Donna, was pregnant. Like Leslie, Donna had assumed she was going to have an average child, and was astonished when her newborn son was diagnosed with achondroplasia. Donna called Leslie to ask for advice, and Leslie was incensed. It was like, "You bitch, I've had to sue him for child support because he's spending everything running around with you. Now you want me to make the road easy for you?" But when Leslie actually saw the baby, Andy, she knew she had a role to play. "I started praying, this is the only brother that Jake is going to have, and I need to get past this." And I did. Leslie took Donna under her wing, set her up with the doctor in Birmingham, and warned her about the orthopedic challenges that lay ahead. Leslie told me, "A year ago, Chris and Donna came to me and said, 'We're working on our will. Would you take Andy if something happened to the two of us? We would want you to have him.'" I just cried. Oh my God, yes. Yes, I would. Leslie and Chris have very different takes on parenting. "Dad is the fear side," Jake told me. "Mom's like, hell yeah, you're gonna play t-ball, you're gonna play baseball, you're just like everybody else." Leslie said, "There's been a lot of clinging. Where are you going, Mom?" "I'm just going to the bathroom. In 45 seconds, I'm going to come out." But he was almost having panic attacks. I said, "Get out of the uterus. You were born. Go away." But he needs someone going, "It's okay. You can do it." Leslie described how she had traveled to a family event when Jake was 12 and how everyone reprimanded her for letting him roam the hallways unsupervised. I said, "He's in 7th grade. You're not thinking what's age appropriate. You're thinking what's size appropriate." Eventually, the typical problems of adolescence set in. "I don't look at myself as a little person until somebody brings it to my attention." "Normally people do," Jake said. Leslie explained, "Everybody loves Jake. He's very popular. Yeah, I'll go to the dance with you. We'll go as friends." They all love him, and Jake's the first one to get out and dance. Both of his counselors over the last 2 years said, "I wish all kids had his self-esteem." But I know we're coming into that painful stage of wanting girlfriends. Leslie decided to take Jake to an LPA convention when he was 13. "We didn't know a soul," she said. He had planned, "I'm going to make all these friends. I'm going to go to the dance. I'm going to do this, that, and the other." Now he was overwhelmed, and I was overwhelmed. Later, Jake said to me, "In regular life, I use my stature to start conversations with people, to make friends. At that first conference, all I had was myself." Jake befriended only tall people that week, most of them siblings of dwarfs. "You're too mainstream," Leslie told him. "Why don't you make some little friends?" But he wasn't ready yet. The next year was different. He became a real teenager, Leslie said. I sneaked into the dance and just sort of pasted myself to the wall. I saw, he's dancing. He's slow dancing. Leslie also caught her son lying about his age to a much older girl. It can be hard to guess the age of short-statured people, and Jake is relatively tall. I said, if I have to bust you myself, you're not 18, Leslie said. But at the same time, I was so glad he could carry it off. Jake adores LPA, but it's important for Leslie that he's happy in his own world as well. As Jake said to me, it's not like it's the only thing about me. The permanent question of cure versus acceptance that runs throughout this book had particular resonance for Leslie Parks. When I met her, she had recently undergone gastric bypass surgery. She had already lost 30 pounds and was aspiring to lose another 100. Being fat was my cross to bear, she said. Being short is Jake's cross to bear. I've had these terrible feelings of guilt that I'm abandoning him. How can I say to my child, you have to learn self-acceptance and be okay with who you are, but yet I'm not? It's not my agenda for him to be tall. But if the work on regulating that gene went to trials, I'd be right there. Feeling so bad about my body, I'm open to what could be done for him. But I don't want to put my issues onto him. Unfortunately, it's almost impossible to get both those messages across. Although most dwarfs are plagued by public mockery and can face serious restrictions and health problems, the cliché that they are cheery children seems to hold. Recent work suggests that this is most probably a form of compensation to ease social situations rather than a trait biologically linked to their condition. Many LPs feel, however, that this view of them trivializes the difficulty of their lives. Initial emotional development appears to be reasonably positive. On measures of overall happiness, LPs fare rather well in childhood compared to the general population. Parents have a difficult time as their children start to ask why they are so different. Euphemizing the details can be as toxic as playing them up. In Living with Difference, the anthropologist Joan Ablon writes, overprotectiveness is a pitfall most parents see themselves falling prey to at one time or another. Dwarf children often complain of being infantilized. In his Guide for Parents of Dwarfs, Richard Crandall, founder of the California-based Short Stature Foundation, recommends, don't give in to the temptation to use a stroller beyond the normal age of stroller riding. Yes, your child may have to take 4 steps for every one you take, and this may slow you down at the mall. But it is better to arrive 1/2 hour early and walk together with your child at his pace than to treat him like a baby in a stroller. The Restricted Growth Association, RGA, the British equivalent to LPA, summed up results from a 2007 survey by observing that those who were treated in a more normal fashion tended to become more self-confident and in turn more accomplished as adults. In adolescence, LPs start showing higher levels of depression as well as lower levels of self-esteem when compared with their average height siblings. Levels of depression seem to be higher for LPs with average parents than for LPs with LP parents, which may imply that despite best efforts all around, parents who know firsthand the trials of being an LP may be able to respond with greater empathy or sensitivity to their child's experiences. More profoundly, it reflects the difference between growing up with a vertical identity and growing up with a horizontal one. Dwarf children, who grow up with adults built like them, internalize a more self-affirming conception of normal than those who are surrounded by family members of average height and proportions. As teenagers reach their full height, the contrast between dwarfs and their peers is thrown into relief. At that point, many LPs who had been content to live in a world of average people begin to feel the acute need for contact with other LPs, for whom their appearance is not erotically aberrant. LPA and similar organizations can be a blessing, though they can equally be a trial. Ablon points out that attending LPA can traumatize people who have blamed all their problems on their dwarfism and who must now come to terms with personal flaws. Dwarfs are stared at more and more as they mature and cease to look simply younger than they actually are. One recent study observed that adults with achondroplasia have lower self-esteem, less education, lower annual incomes, and are less likely to have a spouse. The income statistic bears witness to institutional discrimination against LPs. The study found that while 3/4 of the dwarf's family members, presumably demographically similar to them in most regards, made more than $50,000 per year, less than a third of the dwarfs made that amount. The great majority of college-age LPA members attend college, but outside LPA, the numbers are probably much weaker. Michael Ain, who has achondroplasia and is now a pediatric orthopedic surgeon at Johns Hopkins Hospital, recalled his experience as a medical school applicant. In the one field where you think people would be most understanding, they were the most bigoted. Doctors told me, "You can't be a doctor. Don't even apply." The first guy I interviewed with told me I couldn't hold the respect of my patients because of my stature. The level of prejudice can be truly astonishing. Ruth Ricker, former president of LPA, took a tenant who rents space from her out to dinner, and the waiters kept addressing the tenant, asking, "What would she like to eat?" Ricker said, "I'm the one with the good job. I'm the one with the good education. I own the condo. She pays rent to me, and they're treating me as if I'm completely incapable." Some dwarfs who are not members of LPA regard their non-membership as a political stance. John Wolin, an LP sports writer at the Miami Herald, summed up his issues with LPA by saying, "When one is different, when what you are has the ability to determine who you are, there is an urge to resist." Another LP was quoted in Newsday saying, "Believe it or not, the hardest thing for a dwarf is to meet another dwarf for the first time. When you look into the mirror, you don't see a dwarf. You see what you want to see. But when you see another LP on the street, then you see the truth." Members of LPA often accuse such detractors of being self-loathers who have not come to terms with their dwarfism. And indeed, Wolin describes being guided through an LPA conference by a younger woman who was a longtime member and said, "She was a lifetime of self-acceptance ahead of me." The day Beverly Charles was born in 1973, the doctors told her mother, Janet, that her daughter was always going to be small. But Janet, who had little education and no previous experience of dwarfism, did not understand how small. When she relayed the news to her husband, a Vietnam vet permanently in a wheelchair, he replied, "Small or large, we'll love her just the same." In the months that followed, Janet brought Beverly to the pediatrician once a week to monitor her growth. But Beverly was a poor eater, and her weight stayed relentlessly the same. The doctor said, "We didn't need to worry unless she started losing weight." But that happened at about 3 months, and I was beside myself, Janet recalled. It later turned out that Beverly's nose was completely obstructed. She was unable to breathe and eat at the same time, so suckling was a constant challenge for her. The doctors in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, where the Charleses live, referred her to specialists in Hershey. One of them recommended treatment at a clinic in Germany, and he said he would try to raise money to send Janet and Beverly there. "But I was afraid," Janet told me. "I thought they'd see how little my child had grown and take her away from me." Beverly's dwarfism is most likely the result of pituitary shortage, since she lacks the dysmorphism characteristic of the dysplasias. But the doctors in Hershey said there was no more they could do. No one told them that Johns Hopkins, less than 2 hours away, was a center of excellence in dwarfism, nor that Beverly's form of dwarfism might well have responded to the timely use of injected growth hormone. It soon became evident that Beverly had significant learning disabilities. Her mother accompanied her on the school bus every day so she wouldn't be alone. Elementary school was lonely. High school was horrible. "They teased me and teased me," Beverly told me. One boy bullied her relentlessly. "I don't believe in violence," Janet said. But I told Beverly, "Next time he bothers you, just punch him in the nose as hard as you can." The boy's parents visited Janet and asked, "Where is your daughter who gave our son a bloody nose?" Janet pointed at Beverly, 3'7", sitting on the sofa. The teasing stopped. After high school, Beverly continued to live at home, working first at a Salvation Army shop, then at a printing press. In 2001, when Beverly was 27, Janet saw a mention on TV of an organization called Little People of America. She had never heard of LPA or known that there existed any community of little people. The only other little people she and Beverly had ever encountered were an elderly couple who worked in a grocery store in downtown Lancaster. Janet called the head of the local LPA chapter, saying, "I have to talk to you about my daughter. Will you come have lunch with us at Friendly's?" This was the beginning of what Janet calls Beverly's rebirth. "I wasn't lonely anymore," Beverly said. They attended local LPA chapter meetings, always together, and the following year went to their first national convention. When I met the Charleses, Beverly was just a few days short of her 30th birthday and still lived at home. I was touched by her childlike affect. As we talked, Beverly sat curled in her mother's lap. Janet assured me that outside the workday, they were never apart. "I don't let her go anywhere alone," Janet said. "Look how Elizabeth Smart was abducted. I don't want to take any risks." In New England in the late 1950s, dwarfism was considered shameful. And when Leslie Snyder's mother learned that she had given birth to a dwarf, she had a nervous breakdown and spent 3 years in a psychiatric hospital. "My mother was 38, Leslie said. "She has a very fragile makeup to begin with, and she just could not accept it. So she never saw me, never held me. I was born, and she plummeted." Leslie's father did not do much better. When the doctors told him that I was going to be a dwarf and my mother was shipped off to McLean, it was the last straw. So he moved back in with his parents, and I was raised all around the state of Maine by my maternal grandmother and a couple of my aunts. When Leslie's mother came home from the hospital, she did her best with what she had, Leslie remembered, but my mother never got to grips with my being a little person. When we would go out shopping and somebody would make a comment or stare, my mother would say, "Oh, God, why do I have to deal with this?" Leslie's father remained distant. Her closest relationships were with her babysitters, mostly French Canadians who had migrated to Maine. They were from really wonderful, loving French Catholic families. I used to go to church with them, even though my parents were Orthodox Jews. I hate to think what my life would have been like without them. At 11, Leslie had never met another little person. That year, her mother became aware of LPA and took Leslie to a regional conference. When Leslie was 16, she attended her first national conference. We'd receive newsletters all the time from the national organization, and there'd always be pictures of these young adults having this wonderful time. They were always the same ones. Within LPA, there are people on the sidelines and people who are involved quietly, and then there's the in folks. Somehow, I fell in with that crowd. Leslie had been miserable in high school. I think LPA was what high school would have been had I been average size. Leslie pursued dating possibilities, but it was difficult to get to know someone well enough in a week for a long-term commitment. Many of us end up in relationships that we would have maybe not ended up in had we had more time to think about it. I ended up with a wonderful person, but we were light years apart in terms of interests, Leslie said. For a long time, Leslie wasn't told what had pushed her mother over the edge and into those long hospitalizations, but at some level, she always knew. Her understanding that she had caused her mother to go crazy weighed heavily on her. As a result of that, I'm very interested in early child development and object relations theory, she said. Probably also as a result of that, I have no children. I have a lot of unresolved anger instead. Many of Leslie's closest friends from LPA were from California, so she applied to UCLA and was accepted. She found a therapist and went on antidepressant medication, which she has taken ever since. It made me realize that for so long, I've been operating not quite up to par. All of a sudden, whoa, is this what normal feels like? Leslie was nearly 50 when we met and had made peace with her life. I always come back to feeling that I wouldn't have wanted it different, she said. I've had some amazing experiences as a result of being a dwarf. Leslie befriended Dustin Hoffman when he was working on a project that included a dwarf. She became romantically involved for 9 years with Paul Stephen Miller and got to know many of the people in the first Clinton administration. I was exposed to another life, she said. Paul was really instrumental in my going back to school. When we met, Leslie was running Albuquerque's Protection and Advocacy System, an important civil rights position within local government. I sometimes wonder which has had a bigger effect on my life, my dwarfism or my depression and all the other depression around me, Leslie said. The dwarfism was easier to overcome than the sadness. Since she and Paul split up, Leslie has been romantically involved with Bruce Johnson, an artist who is also a dwarf. I wouldn't be with Bruce if I weren't little, she said. How can I regret being an LP when it's led me here? Bruce's family had been the opposite of Leslie's, open and accepting. When he was born, the doctor's advice to his parents was, take him home and treat him like any other baby, and that is what they did. Despite this, he admitted, sometimes when I watch another dwarf, I feel like we're pretending to be adults. It's a life's project coming to grips with, really, how you look. Bruce is significantly disabled. If I could do it over, I'd want not to be a dwarf. It's been too difficult. I've had many more health complications and surgeries than Leslie, and I'm worn out. She's the best thing about being a dwarf for me, but I'd have loved her anyway. Many dwarfs have agitated against dwarf tossing, a sport in which a dwarf is put into a harness and a person of average height, often drunk, hurls him as far as possible onto a mattress or other padded surface. So far, laws against dwarf tossing exist only in France, Florida, Michigan, New York, and the city of Springfield, Illinois. Both the Florida and French bans have survived legal challenges. The New York ban has required occasional enforcement since it was enacted in 1990. In March 2002, police issued citations to participants in a dwarf tossing competition at a Long Island tavern. A February 2008 dwarf bowling meet planned by a Staten Island bar owner was canceled after a local newspaper reported that this variant on dwarf tossing, in which a dwarf on a skateboard is rolled down an alley to knock over a set of pins, was also illegal. A 2005 SEC investigation into excessive and inappropriate gifts to securities traders found dwarf tossing among the festivities featured at a lavish $160,000 stag party financed by Fidelity Investments for one of its star performers. That such objectification still takes place today is shocking, but the practice seems particularly demonic given the skeletal problems that dwarfs commonly suffer, which can be exacerbated by impact. Dwarfs in dwarf-tossing competitions are often in difficult circumstances and can make a desirable nightly income from participating. Some have protested that they should be allowed to earn their living however they want to, and have pointed out that pro football also leads to damage to the body. Others believe that tolerating the practice injures not only those dwarfs who allow themselves to be tossed, but also the rest of the dwarf community, creating a public perception of dwarfs as subhuman, and thereby perpetuating a climate of ridicule. Opponents of dwarf tossing contend that the tossing of some dwarfs implies the tossability of all dwarfs, and point out that woman tossing, or even dog tossing, would not be allowed. Some within LPA argue that it's also humiliating for a dwarf to play an elf in a Radio City Christmas spectacular. For many dwarfs, however, Radio City and similar venues are easy money, and dwarf actors point out that with few exceptions, most notably Peter Dinklage, who starred in The Stationed Agent and Death at a Funeral, and won an Emmy for his role on the HBO series Game of Thrones, they are seldom hired for mainstream roles. One such actor said to me, "There's an old Spanish proverb, I don't care if people laugh at me, as long as I keep warm." The LP actor Mark Pobinelli said, "When I first get a script, I flip through to see where I'm going to bite someone's ankle, or punch someone in the nethers, or fight the tall guy." In 2009, LPA banned the recruiters for Radio City from the conference. "My daughter did Radio City and she loved it," one parent of a dwarf said. "She's a pediatric oncology nurse. At no point in her life did she think she had to be an elf to make a living." Joe Stramondo, chair of LPA's advocacy committee and a doctoral candidate in bioethics at Michigan State University, said, "When people with dwarfism are portrayed negatively, they are usually portrayed by people with dwarfism. This complicates the issue." Stereotypes are persistent. On the NBC series Celebrity Apprentice, running back Herschel Walker was asked to make a viral ad about all detergent. "What about if we use little people and let them wash themselves in all detergent in the bathtub and you hang them out to dry?" he said. Joan Rivers replied, "We can hang them out on my terrace." Jimmy Corpay, father of a dwarf, argued that these celebrities were encouraging people to point and laugh at his daughter, a common occurrence for dwarfs and one they find exhausting. Corpay said, "Imagine if I said what Herschel Walker did about a black person." He filed a complaint with the FCC. When the skeletons of what appeared to be a race of dwarfs were found on the island of Flores in Indonesia, Alexander Chancellor wrote in The Guardian about the shockingly dismissive tone that was used to describe them. The reports in the media began by describing these ancient dwarfs as belonging to a human species, but then proceeded to distance them from us modern human beings as comprehensively as they could, referring to them as things and creatures, despite the fact that they apparently knew how to make stone implements, could light fires without matches, and organized hunting expeditions. "These are achievements beyond the capacity of most people you see at the checkout counter." Today, the Akha, Efe, and Mbuti people of Central Africa generally grow no taller than 4 feet 10 inches. The word pygmies, often used to describe them, has been designated an insult. But that may be the least of their problems. African pygmies are often worked to death as slaves, have been the target of attempted genocide, and have even been cannibalized by aggressors seeking magical powers. A 2009 article by Lynn Harris on Salon about eliminating the word midget attracted extraordinary response from what is in general an educated and refined readership. One wrote, "Deal with it. Grow a thick skin." "Oh wait, that's dwarves with the thick skin, isn't it? I guess midgets must have thin skin. Too bad. Sucks to be you." Another said, "I wholly support any person or group of people informing me how they prefer to be referred to. However, when these people tell me I must use only approved words, my response is to tell them to kiss my ass." Anna Adelson was born at Beth Israel Hospital in New York in 1974, and when her parents, Betty and Saul, first saw her, they were filled with joy. Betty was able to hold Anna for a few minutes before she was taken away to be cleaned up. The next morning and afternoon, Betty couldn't understand why the nurses wouldn't bring the baby to her. She kept asking, and a nurse finally brought Anna in, but seemed to do so grudgingly. That evening, after Saul had gone home to be with their 4-year-old son David, the obstetrician came in to talk to Betty. He said to me, "I think there's a 50-50 chance that she has Hurler's syndrome, which results in retardation and early death," Betty recalled. Then he left, and alone, I wept through the night. The next day, just before Betty and Saul went home with Anna, the hospital neonatologists told them that Anna had something called achondroplasia. He asked, "Are there any short people in your family?" Betty said, "Our grandparents came from Eastern Europe. We've got lots of short relatives." The neonatologist said, "Anybody with sort of a large head?" Betty said, "Me. I wear big hats." The neonatologist looked grim and said, "She will be short." Betty asked, "How short?" He answered, "Under 5 feet. He did not give any further information about the potential complications, and neglected to mention that most women with achondroplasia are closer to 4 feet than 5. Betty went to the medical library at NYU and read. She wrote to a second cousin who was a pediatric endocrinologist who replied, "There are these organizations, the Human Growth Foundation and LPA. Many people in these groups have good lives. Your daughter will probably be less disturbed by this than you." When Betty and Saul went for walks in their Brooklyn neighborhood, Betty would feel tears welling up every time she noticed a disabled person. "You fight your battles in the world, but you close your door and there's comfort," she said. Now there was no door to close. I wanted to meet another family with a dwarf child, and I wanted to meet a happy adult. I kept in constant motion until I found them. Then I began to breathe again. When Anna was 4 months old, Betty and her family found their way to Johns Hopkins and to Dr. Stephen Kopitz. He would pick up the baby and exclaim in his Hungarian accent, "What a beautiful baby you have." He told you everything you needed to know and what you should look out for. He would write a long letter to your pediatrician at home and make an appointment for you to come back for a follow-up. When we went to Johns Hopkins, I knew the medical part could be dealt with. When Kopitz died in 2002, one mother of a diastrophic dwarf wrote, "I cried more at his funeral than I did for my own father." The mother of an achondroplastic dwarf wrote, "Dr. Stephen Kopitz has to be the greatest man that I have met in my life." In the 1970s, the Moore Clinic at Johns Hopkins had an annual symposium for LPs and their families. Betty went for her first one when Anna was 10 months old. There were all these people in the pool, many with deformities I'd never seen before, adults and children of every shape and size, she recalled, in bathing suits. I would look anxiously and stare, and embarrassed by my staring, I'd close my eyes. Then I'd look some more, until it sunk in. By the end of the day, they had names, and they were people whom I knew. 30 years later, a lot of them are my friends. I am deeper and better for it. Betty Adelson's activist career began shortly thereafter. When Anna was 5, a social worker at the Moore Clinic invited some parents of dwarf children to weekend seminars to prepare them to mentor other parents. Betty and Saul went and soon joined a couple of dozen other families who lived on the East Coast to form a group called Parents of Dwarf Children. Betty and 3 other mothers wrote to the hospitals and clinics in their areas so that as soon as a dwarf was born, they could invite the families to their homes and offer support. "We'd help with information and medical referrals, but perhaps most importantly, offered them relationships with others who traveled a similar path, Betty said. Betty was able to help many parents, but some resisted what she had to offer. She described speaking with a woman who had just learned, in her 7th month, that she was carrying a dwarf. I said, "Look, it's not a garden of roses, but there's a great deal that's fine." She didn't call. So I called her the next day. She said, "We decided to have an abortion." Betty explained that some people in LPA were longing to adopt a dwarf child. The woman said, "It's a second marriage for both my husband and me. We're both very beautiful people. We like to ski. We've had troubles before. Now our life with each other seems to be perfect. We don't want to deal with something like this." After Betty described this encounter to me, I asked, "Would you have considered an abortion if you had known early in your pregnancy that you were carrying a dwarf?" Her eyes filled with tears. "I hope not," she said. "I really hope not." Betty was by then familiar with the impediments that parents of dwarf children encounter. But her Anna was lively and sociable. "I went to the local Montessori school," Betty said. "She did everything she was supposed to. She held the gerbil and played with it. She separated from her mother. She drew. The school said they couldn't accept Anna because she might fall on the stairs." After a protracted exchange of letters, the director backed down. By then, however, the Adelsons had decided to enroll her at a nursery school attached to their local synagogue, where the director had said at an orientation meeting, "If your child has any special needs, please let us know so that we can help." Anna prospered there. Anna has been a vegetarian since the age of 12. She's marched for reproductive rights, and she traveled to Pennsylvania to ring doorbells for Kerry and for Obama. In junior high, when her school didn't want her to go on a ski trip, Anna organized friends to picket the headmaster's office. Remembering the incident, Betty laughed. "So that's my Anna. How could I not be glad of her?" During adolescence, despite overall high achievement, Anna found it hard to concentrate on her studies. She then announced that she was gay. "She came out by calling me from college," Betty said. "The next day, I wrote her a long letter. I told her that what was most important to me was not whether she loved a man or a woman, but that she loved and was loved well. That she experienced passion and the wonderful surprise of finding that someone feels about you as strongly as you do about them, lucky and full-hearted. I knew how important my reaction would be to her, and was glad that I could tell her honestly that I believed that same-sex love was just as true and legitimate as love between men and women." Anna's father and brother were equally affirming. Anna's acceptance of her dwarfism took longer than her grappling with her sexuality. She had stopped going to LPA events in early adolescence, feeling that the world of her average-sized family and friends was sufficient. But despite some hesitancy, she returned when she was 25. She soon became president of her local chapter and organized a Difference Within Difference workshop at national conferences for those short-statured individuals who are set apart from the majority of LPs by race, religion, disability, or gender preference. At the 2004 conference in San Francisco, she initiated the first workshop and reception for LGBT attendees, a breakthrough for LPA, which has many conservative members. She has hosted this group at most of the conferences since. When Anna was still a teenager, Betty decided to write two books, one for a popular audience and one for an academic audience, as a way of paying tribute to and celebrating the dwarfs she had come to know and love. Anna said the project was fine as long as it wasn't a book about her. Several years later, after noticing the piles of folders all over her mother's study, Anna surprised her mother with a present of a file cabinet tied up with a red ribbon and a note that said, "Get yourself organized, Mom." By the time the final drafts were being written, Anna was almost 30, and she acceded to her mother's request to write about her. She is mentioned, with great tact and love, in the afterword of Betty's invaluable The Lives of Dwarfs. That book and Betty's numerous academic articles have helped to organize dwarf history, identifying historical figures who may have been dwarfs, and looking at evidence for the role of dwarfs from dynastic Egypt and ancient Greece up to the present. Much of this history is a narrative of suffering and abuse. Unusual bodies have been described throughout history as reflections of sin, as omens from the gods, as the basis for laughter or charity or punishment. Leviticus stipulates that only men with perfect bodies could become priests, a sign of the emphasis placed on the normative form from ancient times. "I looked for precedents for what I was doing," Betty said. Most of the earlier books had titles like Freaks, or Victorian Grotesque, or Human Oddities. "I thought, there have been dwarves for as long as there have been people. And what were they like? What were their lives?" Until LPA was formed, few dwarves knew each other, except for the ones in entertainment or, in earlier times, the ones sometimes gathered by kings and queens at court. For many years, Betty took a leadership role on LPA's advocacy committee. In 2009, impressed by the enthusiasm of the new generation of dwarfs, she decided that it was time for her to pass the torch. And at the LPA conference banquet, the executive board conferred upon her the group's 2009 Distinguished Service Award. Anna, who was by then living happily with her girlfriend a few blocks away from Betty and Saul, made a moving presentation. "She loves and is loved well, as I had hoped," Betty said. "If Anna had been average, would my world have been narrower? Yes, I recognize the gift that's been given. If someone had said to me, 'Betty, how'd you like to give birth to a lesbian dwarf?' I wouldn't have checked that box. But she is Anna, cornerstone of the family. I wish the road had not been so steep for her, but I'm so glad she managed to climb it with grace." Martha Underkoffer, an LP, wrote in an email to the Parents of Little People in Dwarfism Yahoo News groups, "I have developed a safe and easy system to use. It is a business card. On the front, 'Yes, I noticed your behavior toward me.' For some reason, the public seems to think we don't notice their treatment of us. On the back, 'I realize that you probably mean no harm by your actions and or comments. However, they did cause harm and were not appreciated. If you would like to learn more about individuals with dwarfism, please visit www.lpaonline.org. One LP wrote online, "I've bought myself a little MP3 player, and I listen to music so I can't hear what anybody says about me. And I'm sort of in my own little world, and I can do what I want." The internet has been invaluable for LPs. "The current generation of young dwarfs have an ability to interact that would have been my greatest fantasy," one older dwarf said to me. Harry Weeder was among the most vital activists in the dwarf community. He was physically disabled and walked on crutches. He was gay, he was nearly deaf, he was often incontinent, and he was the only child of Holocaust survivors. He could be overbearing and exhausting, and his activism was always tinged with anger. But he was also full of relentless life. At 57, he was hit by a New York taxi and killed. When I described his litany of challenges, people would make laughing references to Job. Yet he had decided that his disadvantages would be his crown of honor, and he achieved a wild gallantry in his very openness. I can remember his saying that most gay dwarfs at LPA wouldn't identify themselves because of stigma, but that he didn't believe in the opinions of others. He added, "Gay people are called fairies.